table in honor of his wife Shelly on the occasion of their anniversary. Happy anniversary to Bob and Shelly. And remember, again, tomorrow, the Parsha class is tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Thursday night, I have a meeting. So tomorrow night's Parsha class is at 7 o'clock. It's tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. And then next week is, again, 7 o'clock for the Siddur class on Tuesday and Parsha on Thursday. Then we have other special Pesach classes the following week. All right. So we'll start with Rabbi Wittenberg. You're on.
All right. Thank you so much. I tried putting the source sheet in the chat. I tried putting it in twice, actually, but I'll probably also display it on the screen just to make sure, because I never know who's actually looking on or who's not. So, as we were just talking about a little bit a minute ago, Pesach's coming. 3 weeks away. A little more than 3 weeks. No panic. No need to panic just yet, but we're starting to think about it a little bit. Because the Pesach Seder, honestly, might be the most important night of the whole year. What we do on Pesach is we carve out time to just talk about us as a nation. We talk about our foundations as Jews. It's time to re-cement our faith. But most importantly, it's a time to pass on that faith to the next generation. It's a night of Mesorah, on passing on our beliefs, passing on our traditions. But there's something really puzzling about the Pesach Seder. And it's not just one aspect of it. It's one aspect of it that comes up again and again and again. It's the fact that we do all these actions so that the children will ask. Before the Seder has even really started, we take the matzahs off the table as if we were finished the meal. And then later, without much display, we put them back on. Why? So the children will ask. We take our vegetables and we dip them in salt water and we eat them. Why? So the children will ask. And we distribute treats and candy. The Shulchan Aruch says candy and nuts. Why? So the children will ask. Right? We're trying to spark this curiosity. And if we weren't successful at sparking it, if everything we've tried has failed, so then we have them recite the Manishtana, the four questions, just to make sure that they do ask. Just to make sure that there is a question at some point. And the Gemara Pesachim talks about how the Manish Tana, the four questions, is an absolute necessity. So I'll show you here. I'll share my screen for a second. Now unshare, I'll reshare, I'll unshare. Just so you can see in the first source, the Gemara says Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught Chacham, if the son is wise, b'no sholo, then he should ask. Vim eino Chacham, the son's not wise, which I think is a great. Very politically correct way of saying that. So vim eino chacham, if he's not wise, ishto sho'alto. So then the son's mom, or the one who's leading the seder, their wife, should ask. Vim lav, what if she's incapable? What if she's incapable of asking? Hu sho'al la'atzmo. So then the one leading the seder should ask himself the questions. The filu shnei talmid chachamim, even to talmid chacham, even to Torah scholars, shiodim mehilchos a Pesach, they know everything about Pesach. They know from beginning to end. They have no questions whatsoever. Sholin zelaze, even they ask, because that's how important it is to have questions at the Seder. That even to Talmid Chachamim, even a person to themselves, they ask. And it's really kind of odd. Because imagine the following scenario. Imagine you're walking in to the first day of a new class. A new semester, a new class. And when I say this, I'm picturing the lecture halls I had at Rutgers University. These 400-person lecture halls where almost every seat was filled. And so you're walking in and it's a stuffed room. And the teacher walks in, they put down their bag, they take out their papers, And all of a sudden, they jump on the desk and they start doing the chicken dance. They're going crazy. They're going wild. And then someone raises their hand and they say, Professor, what are you doing? And they say, oh, I was hoping you would ask. And they get off the desk. They start the PowerPoint. And they start teaching class. How weird would that be? How many people would go straight to the registrar and they would say, I'm out. I need a new professor. I need a new class. This class is not for me. And yet, that's almost exactly what we do at the Seder. On Pesach, we encourage this wild behavior so that the children will ask. And so tonight I want to try to examine this a little and understand this a little bit better. Why are we so obsessed with questions? Why on this night do we need to go so far as that if we don't get any questions out of our kids, we'll place questions in their mouth? And if there are no kids there, we'll ask the questions ourselves. What is it about questions? What is it about the Pesach Seder? So I'm going to try to give three different views on what the answer might be. So the first one is simply because Jews ask questions. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, that's all, made a lot of contributions to Judaism. I have many of his books, some read and some yet to be read. But I think one of his best contributions was his weekly insights into the Parsha. Because he not only made these great insights, he not only had great insights, but he was really good at relating it back to real life. It didn't stay an abstract idea. He always applied it. He always showed how the Parsha was so applicable to our own lives and how it could help us. And so he, in Parsha's Bo, where the story of leaving Mitzrayim is told, or it started really. So Rabbi Sacks has a piece there about the necessity of asking questions, and he says here in the second source, Judaism is the rarest of phenomena, a faith based on asking questions, sometimes deep and difficult ones that seem to shake the foundations of faith itself. Shall the judge of all earth not do justice? Asked Abraham. So what he's referring to here is when Hashem is going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, and Abraham stands before Hashem and he pleads with him. He says, I'm going to find tzaddikim. I'm going to save these cities. And he asks, is Hashem really not going to do justice? He asks a hard question. Hashem, you're rachem. You're merciful. You're not going to do the merciful thing. You're not going to do the justice. You're not going to do justice. And he pleads with him until Hashem shows him that there's not enough people to save these cities. And then the second question he quotes is, why, Lord, why have you brought trouble on this people, asked Moses. So Moshe, we know, was assigned the difficult task of taking the Jewish people, leading the Jewish people, leading them out of Mitzrayim, and he was at first going to lead them straight into Eretz Yisrael. But when Moshe shows up, things didn't go the way Moshe pictured it. You know, he thought it was going to be easy. He was going to show up. He was going to talk to Paro. Paro was going to say, you're right. You're right. The Jewish people should go. Take them. Leave. But Paro doesn't do that. Instead, Paro makes their jobs harder. They're expected to do the same thing, but they're no longer given the resources to do that. And so Moshe pleads to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He says, why? You told me I was going to take the Jewish people out. You told me I was going to save them. But you've made their lives harder. What are you doing to me? What's happening? Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why do all faithless live at ease? Asked Jeremiah. And the Book of Job, the Book of Eob, is largely constructed out of questions. The gods and God's answers consist of four chapters of yet deeper questions. Right? The Book of Eob is all about Tzadik V'Ra'lo. Why do bad things happen to good people? And he goes on to say, Judaism is not a religion of blind obedience. Indeed, astonishingly, in a religion of 613 commandments, there is no Hebrew word that means to obey. There's no Hebrew word that means to obey. When Hebrew was revived as a living language in the 19th century, meaning with the founding of the State of Israel, and there was a need for a verb meaning to obey, because I guess if you're going to have an army, you need a word that means obey. It had to be borrowed from Aramaic, letzayet. But instead of a word meaning to obey, the Torah uses the word shema, untranslatable into English because it means, one, to listen, two, to hear, three, to understand, four, to internalize, and five, to respond. Written into the very structure of Hebraic consciousness is the idea that our highest duty is to seek to understand the will of God, not just to obey blindly. So Rabbi Sacks is saying a tremendous idea here. We don't just do. We don't just do because we have to. We think about it. We understand it. We get the deeper meaning behind it. And how do we do that? We ask questions. We ask hard questions. And not just us, but those who come before us. We have a whole Masorah, a whole tradition of asking the hard questions. And even earlier in the piece, he points out that in the Torah emphasizes that you will be asked questions. Your children will ask you questions at the Pesach Seder. And not only should you anticipate the questions, but you should be prepared with thoughtful answers. Why? Because this is the Jewish way. We ask questions. And if you're prepared for that, so then you'll have answers. And that's where we come up with the four sons who are at the Pesach Seder. And what's more, one of the most famous Jewish commentators was known for his questions. In source number three, there's a great book called What's Bothering Rashi. It's actually a five-part series. It goes through every single, or I think almost every single Rashi, at least the major Rashis. And he tries to figure out what's bothering Rashi. And in his introduction, he says, one of the Torah's most famous commentators, Rashi, builds his commentary on a question-answer principle. The commentary is meant to answer questions that arise from the text. While this may be true of all commentary, Rashi presents us with a particular problem. He never, or hardly ever, tells us what his question is. Every Rashi is an answer to a question. What is the question? That is the question. So if you've ever learned Rashi, or I'm sure you've heard Rashi quoted, Rashi has amazing, amazing insights. But every single Rashi starts in the same place, with a question. Because that's how he works. Question, answer. Question, answer. There's always something that's bothering Rashi. Hence the title, What's Bothering Rashi? And Rashi came to be known as probably the greatest Jewish commentator. Partially because he excels at this Jewish way of thought. Asking questions and finding answers. In the Gemara, the Tosfos often quotes Rashi as the Perush HaKuntras. So a kuntras is a pamphlet. You know, not a full book, but a little pamphlet. And so, therefore, Rashi was known as the explanation of the pamphlet. Because before we had the Gemara the way we know it, where you have the Gemara in the middle, and Rashi on the inside, and Tosfos on the outside, it used to be just Gemara, and if you wanted the Rashi commentary, you had to go find it somewhere else. And it was a little pamphlet. It became known as the commentary of the pamphlet. And I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, you know, it's one thing to be known as being the author of a book. It's another thing to be known as the author of the book. He wasn't just the author of a pamphlet. He was known as the author of the pamphlet. His commentary was considered so crucial that you had to have it. Someone said to me recently that if you want to learn, well, if you want to learn anything without learning Rashi, learn Chumash, learn Tanakh, learn Gemara without learning Rashi, he said it's like driving a car with your eyes closed. You're not going to make it so far, and you're not going to be so effective. Because Rashi's just that important. And what does he do best? He asks questions. Because it's the Jewish way. And truth be told, he wasn't the first to ask questions. The Gemara asks questions. That's how the Gemara works. The Gemara teaches a Mishnah. It has a teaching. And then it just starts figuring it out. And it's question, answer, question, answer, question, answer. Until we decided that we're happy. We understand as well as we can. And all these farm around me, they also ask questions. That's what we do. We go, we ask questions, and we find answers. It's the Jewish way. There was one scientist, a Nobel Prize winning physicist, actually, named Isidore Rabi. And Isidore Rabi, a Jew, said he was once asked why he became a scientist. And his answer was because every day when he came home, most kids are asked, oh, what did you learn today? He said his mother never asked him that. He said every day when he came home, his mother asked him, did you have any good questions today? And so as he grew up, he learned that what do we do in school? We ask questions. And that's what he kept doing his whole life. He just kept asking questions. And when you ask questions, you find answers. And the bigger questions you ask, the bigger answers you're going to find. Until he became a Nobel Prize winner from his questions and his answers, from his searching. It's just part of the Jewish way. So answer number one is on the Seder night, when we're talking about becoming a nation, when we're talking about the foundations of Judaism, what do? We do the thing that Jews do best. We ask questions. And we make sure we ask questions, even if it's just the Manashtana, even if it's just the four questions. So the second answer is it's to create excitement. This answer comes out of this Haggadah, the Reb Moshe Haggadah, from ideas from Reb Moshe Feinstein. I honestly cannot recommend this Haggadah enough. I wish Art Scroll was paying me to say that. But I can honestly not recommend this Haggadah enough. It's just, I mean, I love everything Reb Moshe does. But the thing that's great about this Haggadah is every idea is super short. It's super short and it's super practical. One paragraph and you get a nice idea. And there's just so many nice ideas to choose from. But he has one here about the Manashtana, about asking questions on the Seder night. And so I have to say, I was talking to someone today, and I was telling them that I no longer underline. There was a time in my life where I used to underline like crazy, and I no longer do it. But it's good. So tonight we're learning not just with me now, but we're learning with me 7 years ago when I felt the need to underline everything because I thought it would help me remember better. But I had one rabbi who told me that the more you underline things, so then the more likely you are to forget it. He said it was a segula for forgetting it. So anyway, Reb Moshe talks about the Manashtana. He talks about asking the questions on the Manashtana and the obligation to ask questions, the question-answer format of the Pesach Seder. And he says here in the last line, so why do we do it? Why do we ask the Manashtana? Why do we, if we can't generate questions, have four questions written out that you have to read, and these are the questions? He says the reason for this requirement is that this style engenders more excitement and leaves a greater impact. So the difference between searching for something and being told it. When you search, you have excitement. You become part of the discovery. If you're told, okay, great. Maybe it resonates. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe you're listening, maybe you're not, but there's not as much excitement there. When I got my smicha from YU, so there's a requirement in YU to do a co-requirement, I guess you could call it. It's not simply that you sit and you learn all day, but you also have to get a degree. And you can get your degree from YU, or you can get your degree from outside YU. So I got my master's degree from YU, a lot similar to a lot of people, and I got it from the Israeli School of Education Administration. And in Israeli, they have this phrase that they like to use over and over again. They call it being a guide on the side and not the sage on the stage. And it's the same idea. It's the difference between searching for something or just telling people something. It's the difference between being a lecturer or putting students in the driver's seat, empowering them, making them excited about what they're doing. Because, yeah, students have to show up one way or another. But they're going to learn way more if you empower them. You give them the tools to go and do it themselves. And I think this is one of the hardest things that schools are dealing with right now in the pandemic. It's not the social distancing. It's not the restrictions. It's not the random COVID tests that you really don't want to engage in when you show up on a Monday morning. But it's the requirement for frontal teaching. My wife's a third grade teacher, and in the third grade, they love hands-on. They love empowering the students, making students part of the process. Because at such a young age, they don't have so much attention span. They can't just sit and listen to a lecture the whole time. But that's a lot of what this year has been. It's been a lot more lecturing. It's been a lot more frontal teaching. It's been very difficult. Much more difficult than the masks and the distancing and everything else. And we always spend Pesach with my wife's family. In particular, we spend it with my mother-in-law's family. So she's one of four. All the siblings come, and they bring all of their kids. And one year, my wife, Yaffa, said to one of her cousins, she said, "Oren, I want to hear some good ideas at the Seder tonight." And that night, I have to tell you, he was on fire. He was asking questions. He was giving answers. She didn't realize what she was doing at the time, but she had just ignited something inside of him. She got him excited. And as soon as he got excited, he was asking questions, giving answers. He was a real part of the Seder. And it was a memorable night of all the Sedarim we've had with her family. It was a really memorable night. So to take this a step further, I'll share an idea that I also saw. Again, I underlined it, which doesn't mean I remembered it all these years later. It just means that when I went and I opened it up again, I was like, "Oh well, I underlined that. And that must have been a really good idea." So this idea comes from An Exalted Evening, which is the Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik Haggadah, written by Rabbi Moshe Ganak. And so, in a very, the Rav language, he says, "The form of narration in the Haggadah avails itself of dialogue. One person asks, and another responds. It's necessary to dramatize this narration because God reveals himself to man if and when the latter searches. If one does not inquire, if one expects God to reveal himself without making an all effort to find him, one will never meet God. But from there, you will seek the Lord and you shall find him if you search after him with all your heart and all your soul." From Devarim. So the Rav's just saying, God doesn't just jump out and say, "Surprise, I'm here. Where have you been? I've been waiting." Right? We have to go find him. So how do we find him? We generate that excitement. We get people into it. We get people excited about the night. And we get them asking questions, giving answers. And then you start thinking more and more and more. And eventually it leads you to Hashem. It leads you to more recognition of Hashem in your life.
this also made me think of another thing, which I didn't put on the source sheet. But the first, if you were to ask me, why do we do mitzvos? Not why. If you were to ask me, what's the reason that resonates most with me about doing mitzvos? I would probably quote to you the first Ramah in all of Shulchan Aruch. The first Ramah in Simen Aleph of Or HaChaim has the quotes a famous pasuk of Shavisi Hashem Lenegdi Tamid. He says, "Hu klal gadol b'Torah." Shavisi Hashem Lenegdi Tamid. I always put Hashem in front of me. He says that is a major rule in Torah, because the more you are involved with Torah and mitzvos, the more you're thinking about Hashem. The more you're thinking about Hashem, the more you are building that relationship. And so on this, and so on the Seder night, when we're trying to think about who we are and where we came from, so Hashem should be a major part of that. So we create excitement, we ask questions, we get people searching and seeking and thinking. And Shavisi Hashem Lenegdi Tamid. We make Hashem such a major part of it. We put him in the forefront of our minds. So hopefully it has an impact on us, not just for this couple hours at the Seder, but also afterwards. That's something we're thinking about, and we're thinking about the questions that we're asked, and we're thinking about the answers that we're given, and it's impacting us for days and weeks and months to come, hopefully. So on the Seder night, when we've carved out this time, when we're taking the time to talk about our faith, to pass on that faith, we have to create excitement. That's why we ask questions. To create excitement, to get people into it, to get people thinking, not just for those few hours, but hopefully for the immediate and long-term future. And then the last answer, the third answer, is to show that faith isn't solely about answers. We have this assumption that you ask a question and you get an answer. That's it. I'm going to ask a good question. I'm going to get a good answer. But maybe you're not. Sometimes you'll just have a good question. Sometimes that question will go without an answer. Maybe for the short term, maybe for the long term. Maybe you'll hear a bunch of answers and none of them will resonate. And that's okay. That's part of our Seder night experience. Rabbi Norman Lamb was known as being a brilliant orator. He was first the rabbi of the Jewish Center on the Upper West Side of New York. And later he was president of YU. And to this day, his drashot are just pieces of artwork. People learn them, they read them, they print them out, they study them, they try to emulate him. He actually once said that a person, a rabbi, gives three drashot every week. There's the drasha that you think about during the week, there's the drasha you deliver in shul on Shabbos morning, and then there's the drasha that you write up on Motzei Shabbos. So the difference between Rabbi Lamb and I, of the many differences, is that I write it up well before Shabbos to make sure that I have it very clear. But Rabbi Lamb, even without writing it up, just by thinking it out, he just spoke poetry. And so this, I have an excerpt from one of his drashot, where he talks about this idea of questions and unanswered questions. I also have a photo of him from later in life. And so he says that even if you have unanswered questions, he says, do not abandon the commandments or prayer or the study, of Torah, at the first or even the second or fifth or tenth sign of doubt. He says, live today. Today, there's always time to question tomorrow. And he goes on to say, he says, I know this is not a permanent solution, right? You can't just always be asking questions and never get answers. And it cannot last forever. If, heaven forbid, doubts hardened into denial, the collapse of Jewish life will fall for that person. But it need not last too long. as long as there are only doubts, terrible as they may be, do not give up on the mitzvot. They are so easy to lose, so hard to rediscover, so simple to abandon, so difficult to relearn. Wait, and your doubts may well be resolved before long. Do not be afraid to live in the tension of doubt versus affirmation and of unresolved uncertainties. It is a sign of genuine maturity. Only children become impetuous and allow their lives to be racked by zigzags reflecting every twist and turn in their mental and emotional states, and come to fateful decisions when dealing with the great issues of life without patience and further reflections. If you are truly a chacham, a wise young man or woman, wait. Perform the avodah Hashem, the service of the Lord, and separate it from your questions. Not that you will not or should not question, do so. And do not hide them, but discuss them openly with your rabbi or teacher or parent or elder or friend or anyone who can give you an intelligent and authoritative advice. But don't mix realms. Do not cross over the boundary into practice so that every question is immediately transformed into a transgression. Thereby, you will be translating every doubt into a denial. That is what I mean by postponing the question for tomorrow. Not a chronological postponement, but a separation of the realm of theory and practice until you have had time to dwell into the question and search for the answer intelligently and patiently. His advice not only is spoken extremely, extremely well, but it resonates with me on a very real level. Because it's okay to have questions. And that's a big part of the Seder night. It's okay to have questions. We're teaching that faith is not just the answers, it's the questions. Sometimes you'll ask a great question at the Seder, and no one's going to have an answer. You're going to have to go find the answer. Look up the answer. Ask someone the answer. And maybe no one will have an answer for you. It's all part of faith. And that's a crucial part of the questions of our Seder night. And we actually see this in the four sons that we talk about at the Seder. I'm going to do it. We see this in the four sons we talk about at the Seder. So in Shmos, where we talk about the four sons, the first is the Rasha. And what does the Rasha say? Vaya ki amra lechem b'nechem ma avoda azos lechem. Your child's going to ask you, what's the purpose of this work? That's what he's going to say. What are we doing? That's his question. And it's a great question. So why is he a Rasha? Because of how it's not because of his question, but it's because of how he treats the question. Because if you look at the next pasuk, then this is the pasuk of the Chacham. He says, "V'haya ki yishalcha bincha machar." Your child's going to ask you tomorrow, lemor, saying, "Ma'azos, what is this?" For Martela b'chozeg yad hotiano Hashem in Mitzrayim beiz avadim. You're going to say, with a mighty hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt, the house of bondage. So what's the difference between their questions? They both said, what is this? What are we doing? The Rasha says it right away. He doesn't stop. He doesn't wait. He just says, what is this? And if you don't give him a good answer, he wants nothing to do with it. The Chacham, he waits. He does everything that's expected of him. Cleaning the house, getting ready for Pesach. He does it all. And then when it's time, when it's the Seder time, when there's free time, whenever that time is, machar, whenever it is later down the line, that's when he asks his question. He lives with the question. For now, he doesn't have an answer. He'll live with it. And when he's able to, that's when he's going to ask. And this is just a major part of faith. And this is one of the reasons why we ask questions on the Seder night. To show that questions are good. Questions are great. Ask a lot of questions. It's the Jewish way. But maybe we won't have answers. You might have to wait. Maybe we'll ask around, or maybe you'll find them on a later day. There's a rabbi in YU I never had him, but I had enough friends who were in his shear, who were in his class, that I felt like I had him. And people used to ask him questions in shear. And the answer, and if he didn't have an answer, he would say, this is a question you should keep in your back pocket. You should keep it in your back pocket, and then you'll meet someone at some point. Or you'll run into somebody, and you'll say, oh, I have a great question for you. Maybe you know the answer. And maybe they will. Maybe they won't. The question shouldn't hurt you. It should stay with you. And when the time comes, you'll ask it. And maybe you'll never meet someone who has the answer. But maybe you'll be reading something, you'll be listening to something, and you'll hear something, you'll read something, and you'll say, wow, that answers my question. And I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me personally. I've had a question, I don't get it, I don't understand it, it doesn't make sense to me. And then I read something. I'm like, wow, you know, that makes a lot of sense. And it's not the times you expected, it's typically the times you expected the least. I'll give you an example. The Bible. I've never understood it. Why would Hashem have to destroy the world? He created the whole world. He should have created it right the first time. So why did everything have to deteriorate and then he had to destroy everything and start again? Start with Noah and his family. And so I was reading a book about free will. I think Dr. David Lieberman, I think. It's called Bechira, Free Will, is the book. And so, obviously I wasn't expecting the answer to come up here. But all of a sudden he threw it in. He threw it in a footnote that I was looking at. And he was speaking about how Hashem destroyed the whole world. He started everything again as a musser to teach us a valuable lesson. That we don't have to despair because of our failures. We can say, it didn't work, I'm going to try again. Hashem said, it didn't work, I'm going to try again, and so can we. And for me, that was a great answer. It made a lot of sense. If the Torah is trying to teach us about how to live the best possible life, so then this is a great lesson we can take from it. That sometimes, no matter how much you love something, sometimes you just have to start again. You have to wipe it out and start fresh. And say, I'm going to do it differently this time. And hopefully, it's going to be better this time. And so you never know. You keep these questions around. You never know when you're going to get the answers. And so on the Seder night, we make that an aspect. And honestly, it's part of our acceptance of Torah. When we accepted Torah, we said, Nasa v'nishma. We will do and we'll listen. Which could be understood as we're going to do the mitzvahs now. And then later, I'm going to try to hear the answers to my questions. Later, I'm going to ask people who I think might be able to help me. I'm going to say, have you ever thought about this? Can you help me answer that? And sometimes the question will be better than the answer. Sometimes you're not going to get the answer right away, but it's all part of asking questions. It's all part of having faith. It's all part of the Seder night. And so just to wrap it all up, I said at the beginning I'm going to present three different ways to look at this idea of asking questions on the Seder night so that the children will ask. But really what I think I did was I presented three different elements of why we ask questions. I don't think there are three distinct answers. I think they're actually just three elements of one answer. Because on the Seder night, what are we doing? We're re-cementing our faith. We're talking about who we are and where we came from. And we're passing that on to the next generation. And so how do we do it? Well, one, we do it the way we know. We do it the way we are best. We ask questions. The Jewish way. Two Jews, three opinions. We ask questions. We question everything. We don't take anything for granted. We gotta get to the end of it. We need to know everything. Number two, we create excitement. Because the questions aren't just, we're not asking questions for the sake of questions. We're not trying to be annoying. We're not trying to, chas v'shalom, do it in a negative manner. We're trying to get something positive out of it. So we're trying to build excitement. We're trying to get everyone involved the best way we can. And number three is we're teaching something very important, very valuable about being a Jew. That we ask a lot of questions. We create this excitement. But we're not always going to get the answers. Sometimes we have to wait for the answers. Sometimes the best answers are the ones that you get down the line when you didn't expect them. Those are the ones that knock you off the feet the most. So I wish everyone a very meaningful Pesach with a lot of questions, a lot of answers, and a whole lot of excitement. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.